In a sense, the facts have always been right in front of us, as appalling and plain as the numbers tattooed under the arms of Nazi concentration camp victims. In 1993, journalist Edwin Black took his parents to the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. They are both Holocaust survivors who escaped before they could be delivered to a camp. An IBM Hollerith D11 card sorting machine stands in the museum's very first display case. A sign explains that IBM Germany organized the 1933 census that identified Jews to the German government. That exhibit set off a number of questions for Mr. Black. How did German forces acquire the list of Jews whom they hunted down all across the Third Reich? How did the Germans organize the relocation of millions of people across a dozen nations, remove them, rob them of their possessions, enslave them, and kill them? How was the largest mass murder in history so efficiently managed? Mr. Black's investigation came back to the initials on that machine, IBM. His book, IBM and the Holocaust, details how a company's genius and that of its executives and engineers was put to wicked use, and it explores the responsibility borne by some of the people who became successful and rich. Edwin Black joins us from our studios in London. Mr. Black, thanks very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And explain to us, please, how this begins with the German census.
Well, IBM and its president, Thomas J. Watson, engineered a strategic business relationship with Nazi Germany from the very first moment in 1933, right through the war. And this endowed Adolf Hitler with the technology he needed to expedite and automate every facet of Jewish persecution. And it began with the census, with identification and other forms of registration, and then it moved to social expulsion, and from there to confiscation, ghettoization, deportation, and finally extermination. I discovered that the Solutions Company had made Nazi Germany its number two customer right outside the United States, and there was no solution IBM was unwilling to provide the Hitler regime.
But now let's make this plain. There is not a memo that says, "Dear Mr. Watson, we need an organizing tool that will help us slaughter Jews and Poles and homosexuals and gypsies and Russians." There wasn't that kind of memo from the Third Reich to IBM, was there?
No, you don't need a memo. You actually have something much more detailed called Mein Kampf, and you have the endless speeches of the Hitler regime. And it was IBM's duty to anticipate the needs of its customers. IBM's notion was you have a problem, you have we have the solution. And each and every solution was custom made, custom designed by an IBM engineer in tandem with its Nazi client. These punch cards began as hand-drawn mock-ups, and the IBM engineer would have to ask not only what information needed to go in, but what information needed to go out. And so, if they would code one column for Jew and one column for Polish, and then occupation was a fur trade, and then Berlin would be coded, by the time you cross-tabulated this information, you could quickly determine how many Jews of Polish ancestry were engaged in the fur trade in Berlin. This was the cross-tabulation expertise that IBM gave to a Nazi Germany. And of course, it was more than just identification and registration. It was the confiscation of assets. It was running the trains on time. Ultimately, there was a Hollerith department in virtually every concentration camp. These machines were never sold by IBM. They were only leased. They were the sole source of the printing of these cards. And they litigated against any other company that would attempt to horn in on its monopoly. This is not only the story of technology, it is the story of monopoly.
To make this plain again, in the instance of IBM, this wasn't just, let me refer to it this way, dumb, smart hardware that they were selling. These are machines they continued to repair, programs, which is probably not a word that was used then, that they continued to upgrade and refine. IBM personnel were, in fact, at the site of this policy.
Well, of course. In fact, Thomas J. Watson was personally micromanaging the German subsidiary hour to hour from 1933 until about the summer of 1940. In fact, Wanson was in Berlin two or three times each year during this period. As late as October of 1941, the IBM general manager for Europe, Mr. Lear, was stationed in Geneva, but he had visited Berlin on a regular basis. And while he is there, he is instructing the German employees to go to Bucharest in conjunction with a German statistical office personnel, and he is arranging this IBM officer who reports directly to New York to move machines trapped in war-torn Poland into Romania just in time for the Romanian census of Jews at the height of the Romanian extermination. And he's reporting all this information in great detail, documents that we have, which are referred to in the book, right to Thomas Watson personally and to the senior staff of IBM in New York and Geneva. There's no question that IBM had to know what was going on. These applications were all custom designed, and only IBM printed the cards. There were only a 2 to 6 month a week supply of cards during the wartime period. Each card looked different. Each card was custom designed. Some had 80 columns, some had 20 columns, some had boxes. These cards were not universal, and they had to be systematically designed and provided by the sole exclusive purveyor that was IBM, even if Hitler had 1,000 Hollerith machines. If only IBM would have stopped printing the cards, they couldn't run. They would come to a grinding halt.
You point out that Thomas Watson, for a period in the 1930s, was the favorite American businessman of the Nazi machine.
Thomas Watson was Hitler's best friend in the Americas and a best friend in the capitalist world. Thomas Watson actually received a medal from Hitler for his help with the Reich, and that was in 1937. He did not give that medal back until the summer of 1940, after World War II had broken out, after Poland had been raped, and at the height of the invasion of Western Europe, when Paris was being bombed and when Holland and the other countries had been invaded.
Let me point out, as I think some people have pointed out in Mr. Watson's behalf, that Americans like Charles Lindbergh, Britons like Bertrand Russell and George Bernard Shaw, sometimes said some things they really regretted during the 1930s. But that was an inconceivable period for a great many people, a great many smart people. And they would point out that in Mr. Watson's defense, when he returned that medal, he also enabled IBM to become a powerful part of the American war machine that defeated Nazi Germany.
Well, when he returned that medal, he did not stop his considerable enterprise with the Third Reich. In fact, in October of 1941, Watson sent a notice out to all of the subsidiaries engaged with the Axis. This is long after the war has started, 2 years after the war has started in Europe. And he didn't say, don't sell to concentration camps. He didn't say, stop designing and producing cards which help afflict innocent civilians. He didn't say, stop working with the Nazis. He merely sent out a notice, don't tell us what you're doing and don't ask us any questions. There were many people who found fascination with Hitler during this period, just as you have said. But the only one that bestowed the Promethean gift of data automation was IBM. And at no point did they stop providing the materials that Hitler needed to proceed with his persecution of the Jews.
You point out, Mr. Black, that under the laws of, I guess, wartime confiscation, arguably IBM Germany ended the war better off than it had entered it financially.
Yes. The documentation shows that when the United States entered the war in December of 1941, it was actually a golden opportunity for IBM, because Nazi-appointed custodians would function as receivers. And they did not loot the company. They merely ensured, as any receiver would, that the companies would perform at peak efficiency, peak profitability, so that the technology could continue to be delivered to the Third Reich. And so, like any good receiver, all the IBM directors and the IBM employees and the staff and the engineer and the managers, these people were retained. And the only thing that that changed was that Watson did not have access to the profits during this period of time, and had to wait until the war was over to collect those. And collect them they did. IBM collected all the money that these Nazi-dominated subsidiaries generated and even obtained the return of their machines, some from concentration camps.
Mm-hmm. You point out in the book very assiduously the chronology against which these events were occurring in the 1930s and the early 1940s. Some critics have questioned, though, whether or not you can really say with confidence that Thomas Watson and IBM executives knew this as of a date certain. I mean, I read, as a matter of fact, in The Economist, British magazine, just a few minutes ago, that the biggest news story in 1938 in the United States was not Roosevelt, Hitler, or the gathering war clouds in Europe, but Seabiscuit, the racehorse.
Well, Seabiscuit, the racehorse, may have been headlines for a moment in time. I'm sure that was the case. Mm-hmm. But I can tell you that the book reflects 1,400 hours of research of the New York Times. While we don't expect IBM to be aware of military intelligence and diplomatic cables, as many researchers have brought to light, we do expect that they will understand what is on the front pages of the New York Times in the newsreels and on the news radio. In 1939, in the middle of September, just after the war has broken out, the New York Times has a story that talks about 3 million Polish Jews about to be immediately, quote, removed from Poland. And the story clearly says that they are candidates for physical extermination. It is just at this time that the German managers of IBM appealed to Watson directly and personally to provide them the high-speed alphabetizers, which they had not had up until this moment. Those alphabetizers were granted in an oral agreement, which was passed through the Swiss office, and that documentation came before the end of September and was after this invasion of Poland. And I assure you, the outbreak of World War II was big news in 1939. That IBM and Watson chose to establish a new German subsidiary, German incorporated subsidiary controlled by IBM New York in Warsaw, maintain a printing plant across the street from the Warsaw ghetto, produce some 20 million punch cards there, and the largest customer, of course, was the Polish railways. It was also in September of 1939, after the outbreak of the war, that Watson chose to establish an international school for training technicians and customer service people in Berlin. The book voluminously recounts what was in the newspapers. So while we didn't expect and don't expect that IBM could have a crystal ball to look into the future, we always tried to give the context of the times. What were people reading when they made their decisions? Remember, in December of 1942, the Allies declared in 44 countries that there would be war crimes for genocide and that no one who cooperated would be excused from the bar. Just a few days ago, I was in Holland, and I had a private tour of the Anne Frank House. And there, October 42, a little girl hiding in an attic heard on British radio, "They're gassing the Jews of Poland." If a little girl understood in an attic hiding in Holland, Watson did too.
Mr. Black, what kind of reaction has IBM had?
IBM has not been able to find fault with even a syllable of the information in my book regarding their 12-year relationship with the Reich. It has been about a month now. The first books were sold just down the street from IBM headquarters on Madison Avenue in New York. As I understand, they have thoroughly read the book. And they have said only that if the material is verifiable, they will refer it to a historian. I think it's time for IBM to understand that this was 60 years ago, a different era, that the people today have nothing to do with that. They need to unbind themselves from this Hitler legacy. They need to open their archives, and they need to come forward and make a statement about what they did and did not do. Everyone knows that they've read the book.
Mr. Black, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Edwin Black speaking from London. His book is IBM and the Holocaust.